Welcome to the Technori Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Catoon. Today's show is sponsored by ActiveCampaign. Go beyond email marketing with true automation by signing up at ActiveCampaign.com/Technori. Get your first 2 months for free. I say this all the time. I'll continue to say it. We use ActiveCampaign. I love it. I am not the smartest guy in the room when it comes to this kind of stuff. And anyone who can make a CRM simple, I'm a fan of them. So ActiveCampaign, thank you very much for the support. This show that we have on next is... I think it's just fantastic in a lot of ways. The healthcare industry is fascinating to me because it's so complex, and the people who seem to disrupt it, whether that's Glenn Tolman and the previously IPO'd Livongo, which we mentioned in the show, or it's GoHealth that recently got acquired. VillageMD is a gigantic beast, a unicorn. It's a beast company that is, I think, is gonna rewrite the way a lot of things are done. And if you listen to the show with its one of its co-founders and CEO Tim Berry, you're gonna glean a lot of things, and you're gonna learn a lot about healthcare that you probably didn't know. You're also gonna learn that like the solution isn't that complex. It's actually really simple. It's the most intuitive thing ever, which is to say we should help patients. We should focus on patients who need help the most first. Not the most ridiculous thought. However, if you're inside of healthcare, you'd recognize kind of quickly that the fee system kind of disables that. It makes it incentivizes you maybe to just take the money and not care as much about the patient, which creates a whole lot of problems. And those problems are solved by VillageMD. I'm going to leave you to just listen to the show because there's so many good things, but I will leave you with this because I think it was funny. I came into the show and I'm like, you know, I get a lot of companies that come through here and they have wackadoo names and whatever. Not that VillageMD was a name I didn't get. I totally could understand it conceptually. But it wasn't until after the show that I completely realized why it's called VillageMD. And I will leave it at that. You can listen to the show with Tim and see if you can figure it out first, because I don't even want to share it, because it's actually worth thinking about. If what popped into my head, and by the way, I reveal it at the end of the show, if what popped into my head pops into your head, I think not only will you learn about healthcare and the company, but you'll also learn a little bit about how you name a company, which I think is kind of important. Before we do the show, though, I have to tell you, if you like this show, you will also love a show we did a week ago with Mindy Knebel, who is the from Kaizen Health. You can follow Technori at Spotify or Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. People say that all the time, and I probably shouldn't say that anymore, but go to Spotify and follow Technori's podcast. Listen to Kaizen Health. You can also check out Calderos or Kin Insurance or Clear Cover, many others that are like this show. I think you'll enjoy it. Events that I'm going to be attending. One that I think is worth your time if you're in the Chicago area at Tech Nexus next Tuesday. Tuesday is the 29th, if I am correct. I'm going to be sitting on a panel with fellow CEOs talking about sort of the CEO paradox among tech. And it's an early stage founder who's been on the show also, but I think both of them have been on the show, Caben Clausen from True Republic. They are kicking ass and taking names. And my good buddy, my Glen Ellen pal, Justin Ullman from Rhino Docs. We are going to be on this panel. I believe it's 3 o'clock p.m. Central Standard Time at Tech Nexus. And you can just go to Tech Nexus or email somebody at Tech Nexus to get tickets or just show up there. I just show up to this stuff. I don't know about you people, but I don't do links. Links, just not for me. Anyway, this is my interview with the founder and CEO of VillageMD, Tim Berry. Okay, so there's no better way, I feel like, starting a show when I have an entrepreneur who has sort of a... We have very different paths, but there's some commonalities in sort of like accidental entrepreneur got into it and figured out like, oh no, this is what I want to do. I just didn't call it that. And turns out even more aligned in the sense that we both kind of got our starts trying to pitch to big media entities that maybe didn't or did go so well. I'd love to know your, just to compare notes, your experience walking into a Tribune style company and trying to pitch them. What did you pitch, and what was the gist of your opportunity?
So in 1999, I started a company called Evo Knowledge.
Okay.
The company was, the whole premise was based on a Benjamin Franklin quote that knowledge is not knowledge until shared.
Okay.
And so
they should jump on this. This is a good start.
So I think so, right?
Yeah.
So part of it was the idea of going out and building kind of video montages of key learnings that people have inside of different companies. And there's got to be a way to expedite the knowledge transfer, right? So go to the best and brightest in each company, try to encapsulate all that they know about the way that they do their job, create video montages or learnings from it, and then disseminate it across the enterprise, right?
Yeah.
And so I had pitched the Tribune on on potentially being a customer. I also pitched them on a PR story, which was to do a 12-week feature called Diary of a Startup and to try to chronicle my startup and the buildup of the business over a three-month period. During those 3 months, Tribune did not sign on as a customer, but they signed on for the PR story, which was great, but never materialized.
So I have a similar, far less successful, you learned a lot, obviously, from it.
Totally.
We'll get into the whole spiel of how it has transpired over the last 25 years or whatever. Mine was a much better learning, for me at least, but one that was poorly timed, and I was really not looking to learn at that exact juncture. I was kind of looking to scale, and that wasn't a good outcome. So it wasn't with Tribune. I was pitching to, at the time, the Sun-Times was owned by Rapports. And so I'm sitting in the room with Tim and Tim and Tim Lannon and Tim Knight that was running it at the time. And we had this company called Warbler. And the idea behind it was basically, if you have, you know, every Sun time, every time, you know, Naperville, Evanston Sun, whatever, that you would be able to sell more advertisements if every one of those towns had an app that the homepage was the Sun Times like anything else. But the minute that they got to their local stories, it would kick over and the advertisers would be local instead of selling, you know, Ace Hardware from wherever the hell they are
right.
to get in there. I thought it was brilliant. And Tim, who was a very forward-thinking investor at the time, and not that he's not now, but he was at least thought of that way then.
Yeah.
And I sat down, and I was shocked as shit that I even got in the boardroom. Like, I don't know what I'm... I just left Northwestern. Like, this is craziness. And it was actually a project that I was building at Northwestern that, like, started this. I don't know what I was doing. They start throwing around numbers of, like, 10 million, 12 million, 15 million. And I'm just like, oh, my God. Like, I hit it already. Like, I'm done. I'm 27 or whatever, and I'm done. And we get three or four meetings deep into it, and they're loving it. They're mocking it up, and they have us draw up Evanston Sun, and they actually had me go out and sell some ads just to see what it would look like. And we did. And then all of a sudden, the conversation starts happening between them and the Tribune. Tribune's going to acquire all their properties. And me being the moron and not knowing anything, I got greedy. And I also thought, this could be better than I even thought.
Right.
Because the Tribune, I mean, whoa.
Your $10 million went to $50
million. Oh, at least. I think I had earmarked 29 was the number in my head.
Okay.
I was like, this is going to be the... Because I started adding up. I was like, well, if you did the same thing in all the cities, LA, and where they had... I was like, this is huge.
Yeah.
So I go to Tim, and I'm like, you know, should we ink a deal now and then have an earn out at the end, like what we're going to do? And he's like, you know, Scott, I think, honestly, from entrepreneur to entrepreneur, and it's like a long wink that I should have caught, he goes... I think you should wait and pitch it to them because they told us when we told them about this how much they loved it. So he blows me off, gets the deal done behind, you know, I see in the newspaper that Tribune buys all their stuff. And I set up a call with some people at Tribune. I go over there and the guy literally, swear to God, looks at me and goes, no effing chance. Zero. Zero chance. And I'm sitting here going, we could have literally at any time the month prior had an LOI for at least $1 million
right.
to build Evanston and call it a day. And me being a moron and greedy read him thinking, well, of course he has my best interest.
Yeah.
And from there on out, it was like, I learned obviously to be smarter and to do my research and understand contract. But I also, it was like this, like, this is weird. I enjoyed the kick in the gut.
Yeah.
There was something about it that made me sick, but then I also was like, oh, so like, yesterday life was amazing and today life is just miserable.
So it's funny, I you think about the different types of entrepreneurs who are out there, and you've got many who are creating, you know, they buy a restaurant and they want to, you know, create great service for their local community, and that works well for them.
Yeah.
And then there's entrepreneurs who are trying to build scalable companies, right? And in your case, it was a scalable company. In my case, it was trying to build a scalable company. And the mistake that so many young entrepreneurs make, I think, is that you start to, you know, see the vision or opportunity of a $150 million deal, and you just get fixated on that as opposed to going out and just hitting singles to actually build a business, build cash flow. And only when you've been in business for a while,
yeah,
and you've had enough singles and doubles, do you really get the chance to hit the home?
John, I mean, we had John Morris from Rise Interactive on it, and he almost said that verbatim. He was like, the number of deals that I turned down because I thought, really don't belong here.
Yeah.
It's like, and there's a difference between being confident and thinking I belong. It's not about that. It's just like self-aware.
Yeah.
I don't belong in this. I'm probably not going to be able to serve like what the contract asks for. If I do, I'm going to have to be leveraged to the hilt. And I just think it's not the right time. So let me make real deals that I can manage and perform really well and outperform. And then those deals will come to me later. And then there's, of course, founders who just rebrand co-working spaces and walk away with 1.7 or whatever. That's insane. But no, it was an experience that I think is transformative, because when I'm leaving Northwestern, and this is like in, you know, 2012, the heyday of like startups are just getting going in Chicago. And I was still looked at as like, why wouldn't you go work for one of the big three? You know, PwC at the time, Booz Allen was like hanging out outside of Kellogg, like just grabbing people off the floor. And I did this one thing, and it turned into a business for me and became an entrepreneurial career after that. But like I thought for all intents and purposes, I was going to take some quick money and then I was just going to go work for Booz and just invest, and life would have been grand. Life is still grand, but it took a little longer.
Different kind of grand, yeah.
It took a little longer.
Well, and the funny thing about it also is that people don't realize the lessons that you learn. Like going out and failing as an entrepreneur, by far greatest thing that ever happened to me, right? The first company I started, put my heart and soul into it. I had these moments where I was convinced we were going to be a $1 billion enterprise. And at the end of the day, it ended up being an economic failure for me. But yet the set of experiences during that multi-year period clearly helped shape what I do today, right?
Well, fortunately for you, there's a $1 billion company sitting right in front of you almost very soon here. They call it the Sunicorn. That's where I view you guys at. I think we're going to get into VillageMD and all of that, but I do think that we're onto the right track with learning sort of what it's taken for you to get to this spot, because I think a lot of, like myself, young entrepreneurs, but even those who are older but new to entrepreneurship, they do get a little bit blindsided by the valuations and the Crunchbase, TechCrunch, Chicago, and all of the coverage, making it seem like, well, geez, if you have a great idea and there's a big market, then duh, you're gonna get it and you're gonna raise tons of money. And I almost think, and we obviously kind of build this into the investment, you know, profile, but I don't trust the instincts of an entrepreneur or a founder or even a CEO if I don't feel like their past will dictate the decision making, that they will then have that good cop, bad cop on their shoulder to be like, can you sense that there's something coming? Because if you can't and you haven't been there, then I don't know if I trust handing you $100 million check. Like, So I'd love to learn your, just literally like from the first company, our Tribune intersection, and then the next company, economic, not huge, but there was more to this. This is your upbringing, and then there is the time at a big consulting firm. What do you think is the beginning, the budding of your entrepreneurial journey? Do you think it was just sort of like opportunities that arose, or was there something dating back to your childhood that you were like, I think differently than the pack. I see things differently.
Yeah. So I do think that my upbringing had an influence on me as an entrepreneur. But not in the way that many people do. So I there's a lot of people whose parents were entrepreneurs, yep, and therefore they saw that path and saw it as the only path.
I was the opposite, like that.
Right. And so I was raised in an amazing family, and my parents were people that really encouraged me, my brother, my sister, to go out and extend ourselves and be involved in the community. And we were very involved in our Catholic church. We were very involved in the school. We were very involved in sports. And I watched my father organize a lot of things across our community. So it was starting up.
Are you from here?
I'm from Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin.
Okay, all right, yeah. All right. I went to Marquette, so that, you know,
there you go.
A little bit there.
I'll give you some cheesehead credit.
If I tell you another entrepreneurial story, that'll go right out the window. But continue.
But the thing about it is that I saw my father extend himself to help create things that frankly didn't exist prior, right? Yep. So it could be a basketball tournament for girls age, you know, fifth grade to eighth grade, right? It could be starting a church picnic or a community celebration on the 4th of July. And so it was all these things where I saw him be very involved in the community. And in turn, he brought us into that. And so when you learn as a very young age to kind of take on leadership responsibilities without ever thinking that it's leadership, right? Yep. So if it was a simple basketball tournament and no one was working the concession stand, then you just stepped in and you did it. And I was 10 years old and I was doing it, but you could add, you know, a nickel, a dime, and a quarter, and you could figure out a way to help service customers. And so there's so many things that were a part of my upbringing that I realized as I kind of went through school and started working that were clearly experiences that taught me to lead, that taught me to roll up my sleeves and do whatever it takes to get the job done, to go out and sell. I mean, so many entrepreneurs, and to your point about not trusting, you know, people who might have great backgrounds and great resumes.
It looks great on paper.
They look great on paper, and all of a sudden you realize, well, gosh, they really are good at selling because their business card says Google or Microsoft or Amazon. Like,
you forget that they had tremendous support.
Well, that's the point, right? So there's a mentor, a guy named Jerry Mitchell, who said to me at one point in time when I started my first company, until your name on the business card supersedes the name of the company on the business card, you'll never have really made it as an entrepreneur, right? And I didn't really
plus the company brand is so weak that it's just, you know.
Well, but his point really is that obviously you've got to go out and make it, right? And so if you establish your own name and you can build trust and credibility and people will buy from you, because at the end of the day, starting any company, if you can't go out and sell, I think you're in a world of hurt, right?
I think I've heard numerous what I call, you know, investors that I respect. Yeah. Not that I don't respect everyone, I do, but like, it's like there's certain people that just, you see them, you're like, all right, this person knows a little more than the average Joe.
Yeah.
Talk all the time about if your CEO is not your best salesman, you're probably going to run into a problem at some point, because you are going to end up in one of the valleys we talked about, and somebody's going to have to sell out of it. And the only one who can do it is the one who believes it so mightily that they can blindly sell. And usually that's the CEO, or at least you hope it's, you know, one of the technical founders.
Which, you do hope that.
Key word here is hope. It's funny because we, you know, I came from a family not dissimilar from yourself. You know, my mom, everyone in their family, Catholic Church, the whole nine yards. My dad was a salesman. I spent my entire life every summer traveling with my dad and sitting in boardrooms across the country as he's selling. And I just sat there and listened to people and how they responded and how the relationships were forged and all this stuff. And I had no idea what the purpose was. I was just hanging out, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, you fast forward, you know, 20 years. And I never understood why I struggled in school and different things, even sports. I struggled with coaches. I didn't take coaching well. I always thought, it wasn't that I thought I knew more, I just didn't take to it. And it only took until I had a couple of regular jobs where I was like, I'm doing good work and I'm not being rewarded for it. And I don't know why I'm being pigeonholed before I recognized that what I had caught, and I think this is it, is that I heard the whole conversation as a child going between the buyer and the seller, the value prop versus the value add. And in my mind, I was able to navigate the path of least resistance. So I knew how to cut all the bullshit out and just go, you want this and you know I have it, and I have this and you have this and I want it, and I'm going to trade you, and this is how we're going to do it. And I would negotiate with teachers. I would negotiate with coach. I was negotiating with everybody.
Right.
And when you're 15 years old, they're not interested in your negotiating. And when you're a new, fresh, out of school undergrad working in a company, they're not open to your negotiations. And it got to a point where I was like, well, then if the only time I can do it to negotiate is negotiate with my own name, then I'm going to do it with my own name. And that's how it all kind of started.
Yeah, I have to admit, I personally floundered. Once I left college and started working, I floundered until I got to the spot where I could have the opportunity to, you know, create my own success and create my own failure. Right?
How long were you working in consulting before?
So I had done it for 4 years.
Okay.
So I went to business school, worked in consulting for a while, and then it was just the draw and attention of being in an entrepreneurial environment. Kind of, I got comfortable with it, and then once I was there, I knew that that's sort of.
I didn't have the patience to wait, and it sounds kind of like you didn't have the patience. Like, you're floundering around, and it's like, this is just not fulfilling. And I wonder if it's just like one of those signs of an entrepreneur. Not that it's not a general statement, but like, most successful CEOs and entrepreneurs that I know, they couldn't even do it if they wanted to. Like, if they had no choice in the world and their family needed their money, they still couldn't go sit in an office and just sit there and wait for their turn.
Yeah.
It's just not in their DNA.
And I would say that that is definitely true of a cohort.
I can be patient in my company now.
Right.
It's just not for you.
Yeah. Well, and part of it also is, I think, finding the right environment so that there are opportunities inside of larger organizations where they have huge appetite for growth, and you find that right cocktail of leadership that is going to allow you to go out and break glass and do whatever is necessary to grow, and then also give you the right level of capital to achieve that. If you can find that mix, which doesn't always exist, then I think you've got a great recipe for success inside of a large company, and you can create huge scale change, right? So I think about it. I was working in Houston, and I joined an organization called Universal American, and Universal American had purchased a Medicare Advantage plan in the Houston market in 2006. And this is sort of after the Medicare Modernization Act of 2003 was signed into law by George Bush. And this is a traditional insurance company, a Medicare supplement insurance company, that bought an MA plan and had no idea what they were going to do with it.
Yeah.
But the CEO was bright enough to know this is where the world's going, and I'm going to put capital and energy, and I got to put leadership behind it and see what can happen. And so they brought me in to help grow that business. And in the span of about 4 years, we went from a $140 million business to a $2.8 billion business. And it's in those environments and that kind of scale that you as an entrepreneur, if I was starting it by myself, it'd be a little hard to go from zero to 2.8 in 4 years. But when you have that kind of support, it can be a really fun environment.
So it's funny you mention that, because it goes back to the kind of two points. The one being being tested, right? Knowing you've got the metal to go through it when things are rough. I have these poor kids that they send me to mentor from Northwestern and from Marquette. I have one right now who literally is like, I want to be an executive. My dad's an executive. He's like really into it, right? And he's like, but I don't know what I should do. Like, should I take this degree and go get a job and like work my way up? And I'll spare you the long, garbage mentorship that I attempted to give him. But the crux of it that I think I gave that was real, and it relates right to this, is I think at this stage, when you have the ability to go out and try something on your own and work at a startup and feel the pain, you learn stuff. Yeah, you might make some connections and network and so forth. But what you really get is to test yourself and find out, when things get rough, can I scramble? Because if you can test yourself and learn that you can scramble, it doesn't matter if anyone else believes it. If you believe you can do it and you can handle it, then you should go back into, if you want to be an executive of a bigger company, then you can go back into that system and you will make your way to the top, because you'll be one of the few people who, every single time a crucial decision comes up, you are unafraid to make a move. And you know that you'll get through it because you feel the confidence of being like, I've done it and not succeeded, and I've done it and succeeded, and I know the difference.
Yeah. What wanting to be in the spot where you get to make that decision. Yeah.
That's a rare thing.
Critical, right?
I think that's a very rare thing.
It really is. And the other side to it is, I think being in an environment where you are cognizant that you're going to screw up,
yep,
right? You're not everyone's going to go to the plate every single night and hit 1,000%, right? You're going to screw up. Did you learn?
Seems like Mike Trout does, but anyway, continue.
But at the end of the day, did you learn, right? Because there's a lot of people who say, oh, I tried this, it didn't work. Here are all the reasons why I'm now the victim and it didn't work out well for me, versus I look at every time I've failed, even in the creation of this current business, I think you have to look yourself in the mirror, have the humility to say, what could I have done differently? And not so much spend your life second-guessing every decision you make, but having the wherewithal to say, I could have made a better decision here. I could have handled this differently. We could have, sold more here. We could have negotiated a little less here. I mean, there's always trade-offs, and you have to have that wherewithal to be able to say, good decision, bad decision, bad decision, what I learned.
I'm kind of obsessed with this book called Principles right now, with Ray Dalio from, is it pronounced right? Dalio?
It's one of the nine books on my bookshelf.
Oh my God.
My bed right now, yeah.
Be a weirdo and get it and get the audio and download the app. I'm serious. Ray's key principle. It's amazing. Anyway, I'm obsessed with it. The one thing that he said that like, I will remember this above anything else, and I'm sure there's more because I haven't finished it. He said the one thing that I had to learn after I basically bankrupted the company down from 100 people down to just me, was I used to say, I know this. I know I'm right. And he said, you have to change the thinking of your brain and the wiring to go rephrase that. How do I know I'm right? Add how. I know I'm right. How do I know I'm right? If you can answer how you know you're right, then you can proceed. If you just know you're right, but you don't know how you know you're right, then you got to walk away.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things like, oh my God, it's so right. Cause you get blinded in your arrogance when you have success. It's just, it's inevitable, I think.
Yeah.
Unless you have the, foundation to be like, all right, I do know. So was this company, was this the jump in for you into healthcare? Was this your first sort of foray?
No. So I had spent some time working at Blue Shield of California,
okay,
where they asked me to come in and, kind of start a couple of different new initiatives and growth areas for the business, and then enjoyed the time and experience there. And they asked me to run strategy and performance management, and I realized that when you're in year 35 of a 99-year strategy, that there's not a whole lot of innovation that's going to happen here. And so I left, went to this other organization in Houston and ran the Medicare Advantage business. And then from there, moved up to Chicago, where I started the population health business for Accretive Health,
okay,
Chicago company. And then 6.5 years ago, myself and two other guys came together and said, we've been organizing primary care physicians around the country, and we've been demonstrating that if you give primary care doctors the right incentive to provide better clinical results and reduce the cost of healthcare, and then you give them resources to be successful at doing that, they're going
to
do it.
It's time for you guys to build a dashboard and tie it all together.
Exactly.
Call it VillageMD.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's an awesome story. I think it helps make a lot more sense of where things are going and where things are for you. I think one of the fascinating components here is healthcare, and we've had several people, as I mentioned offline on the show, that are in the space, and they all have some optimistic, some pessimistic, some opportunistic views of healthcare. And I'm just curious, because many of them have been very successful. So I already know, you know, with Livongo IPO and Go Health and the exit and all this stuff, all of those people, by the way, have one of those three viewpoints on it, and none of them are the same. And I'm just curious where you stand on it, because you obviously see the opportunity that can be created if you get all of the practitioners together in the right line and provide them with the best quality care. What did you see as an opportunity for you to be like, our first beachhead to get ourselves established is going to be this, and then we're going to scale it by doing what's next?
Yeah, so a little bit of history. The Medicare Modernization Act of 2003 introduced this idea of the government paying an insurance company, a Medicare Advantage insurance company, a different premium amount depending upon the exact acuity of each individual Medicare beneficiary.
Okay.
Right? So if you think about the world of insurance, historically, it's all based on this pooling. And the way an insurance company prices an insurance product is you look at your pool of risk and you try to figure out, all right, is my risk going to get more or less? And then do I price it accordingly? And then after I price it, I pray to God that the risk I get comes in less than what I priced.
So the business model is akin to, say, CME Group.
Exactly, right. So I mean, that's sort of how insurance, and it's health insurance, it's property and casualty, it's life, you name it, that's how it works,
yep,
right? So this is the first time that the government said, if you have 1,000 people or you have 1,000,000 people that are your insurance pool, and they are 2 times sicker than
whoever else would
be. Yeah. The rest of the pool that's out there, we're going to pay you 2 times more, as opposed to if you have a pool of people that are 50% as sick as everybody else, we're going to pay you 50% less, right? And so when that was signed into law, there was a light bulb that went off for me that said that insurance companies have had a 60 or 70 year run of failing to deliver better clinical outcomes in reducing the cost of healthcare, right? So at the time, you know, our healthcare system used to be $1.5 trillion. Now it's $3.5 trillion, on its way to $5 trillion in the span of the next 5 years. But largely, if you think about who's had the opportunity to try to organize providers to deliver better outcomes, it's largely been insurance companies, because the federal government through CMS and employers have entrusted insurance companies to be those organizers and enablers. And fundamentally, they've not been successful at it. And so when this came into being in 2003 and then started to be introduced in 2006, the light bulb went off. It said, if we're going to actually deliver a different kind of result, we have to take better care of sick people, right? Yeah. Now, that's about as duh of a comment as you can make to anyone who's not working in the healthcare industry, right? Like, yeah, the goal of the healthcare industry should be to take care of people who are really sick, and let's do a really good job of getting
the best care possible. But not if that's how you didn't make money that way before.
But we have a fee-for-service healthcare system that everyone is feasting off of the fact that people, quote-unquote, need more and more healthcare.
Treatable, not curable.
So the question for that we posed was, do we really need to... Is it necessary for people to have all the admissions that they do, right? So patients who have COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, in the Medicare population, they represent 10% of every Medicare pool. They incur over 35% of the total medical spend of every Medicare pool, whether you're in Bangor, Maine, or whether you're in LA, California. And so the question is that, are we delivering the best possible care we can to those people? And so for us, it was sort of this recognition of a decade of the industry starting to say, yep, we're starting to realize that if we're going to have better outcomes, we're going to have to care for people who have chronic disease differently.
Yep.
And so, and thankfully for us, we had a decade of experience, the three founders, organizing doctors to prove that. And so now it's just a matter of going out and doing it by ourselves. So we started in Houston. We started with 13 primary care providers. There's an existing group in that market that we entered into a partnership with, and then spent the better part of the first 2 years of the business just proving that we could grow, we could add more providers, that we have, in fact, built a better mousetrap, that primary care physicians want to be a part of a model that really is focused 100% on delivering better health care as opposed to referring to specialists or feeding a hospital. And so we said we want to be in a spot where we're demonstrating we can grow, we can deliver better health care quantifiably, better clinical results, lower total cost of care. And then once we start doing that, let's start looking at other markets to expand into. And so from there, we went from Houston to Indianapolis, and you know, we're now in 8 markets. There's 2,600 PCPs that we work with, and we're on a good roll.
Sounds like a plan to me.
Yeah.
So the question there is, when, you know, obviously you mentioned that there's the kind of a duh moment that, like, people would have just assumed that makes sense, except for those that are actually in it, which I guess is kind of how this goes in most industries. It's the people who are in it are like, no, we don't do things that way. And it's like, you really should. Like, just look at it. Were you at the time contrarian? And you're seeing this, like, the aha moment for you, were there other people in other businesses that were like, aha moment also, and they're chasing after this? Do you have a bunch of other people who recognize the opportunity, or were you guys kind of going against the grain a little bit with your plan?
So I think that we have largely gone against the grain for the better part of our tenure in the organization, right? Yeah. So I think the industry at large is starting to realize, hey, if we're going to have better clinical outcomes and a lower total cost of care, we need to have more primary care doctors, and we need to have primary care doctors who are not just referring to specialists, but are actually treating and taking care of patients and solving their problems. And so the good news is that you've got the CMS, right, Medicare and Medicaid, that's saying we want to be supportive of primary care, and we want to introduce new economic models that reward primary care physicians if they demonstrate they deliver better health care. The challenge is that well, take a step back. You have the industry that's largely acknowledging that's where we want to go, but you also have this sort of addiction to the crack cocaine of a fee-for-service healthcare system. And so people are, quote-unquote, trying to live in two worlds. And our view is there's only one world to live in. We are healthcare providers, and we should be providing the best care we possibly can to all of our patients. And so we have a purity of focus that allows us to really differentiate vis-a-vis many others who are starting to come along, but frankly are... They think they can flip a switch someday and just start magically providing better health.
Except they don't have the 8 to 10 year run that you guys had to learn all the things they're going to find out.
Exactly.
So the question that I'd have then is, I guess it's the $100 million question. As they start to figure it out and they start to recognize that this is the right way to go. And this is, I guess, a good analogy for listeners, and this is sort of like the Robin Hood TD Ameritrade effect. So, like, Robin Hood sets itself up as a no-fee trading platform, and everyone's like, oh, my God, and you get investors that never touched it in their life. And everyone else starts to recognize, oh, if we got rid of the fees, how much more money could we make? It takes 6 years for everyone to catch up and do it, but now that they do, people are standing there going, well, what's Robin Hood's differentiator? And the question that is posed is that, like, their app and everything, the user experience is fantastic. But will that hold on long enough? And I bring that over to you in the same thing. Is like, as all these people start to catch on to it, what are your differentiating mechanisms and levers that you can pull? Is it operational expertise? Is it design and just ease of use? Is it relationships? Is it everything? How do you view the competitive landscape once everyone recognizes, like, wow, that was the way to do this?
So it's a great question. And I think in some ways this is great. And as a voting citizen in this country, this is unfortunate. But I don't think that the healthcare industry is going to jump on this en masse.
Well, the fragmentation, I think, almost eliminates the opportunity for that.
Right. So I think we're living in a world where, while we are 6 to 8 years in front of many others, I actually think we will end up being 16 to 18 years in front of many others.
Yeah.
Before every provider in this country is focused on value.
Yeah.
And that as the pure model they think about care delivery, right? So and part of it's just a rationalization of they're running hospitals, they're running ambulatory surgery centers, they're running specialty clinics, they're running skilled nursing facilities, and all of those things get paid when they do stuff, right?
Yeah.
And so I think as a practical matter, it's going to be really hard for people to think differently for a really long time. And so the ways that we think about building that element of differentiation are really twofold. One is a cultural aspect. So when people come to work at VillageMD, they understand that 1,000% of what we do in terms of physical capital, resources, et cetera, is on the physician and the patient.
Yep.
And the rest of it is periphery. And if we're not focused on that 10-foot bubble that surrounds a doc and a patient, then we're not doing the right stuff, right?
Yep.
So there's a maniacal focus on that culturally. The second thing is that we have invested, and we invest 6 to 8% of our revenue in technology R&D.
Yep.
And so we've built a tech platform called DocOS. It's an operating system that's frankly remarkable. And we what we've done is we've integrated with 45 different electronic medical records, 80 different payer claim systems, 100 hospital systems, pharmacy systems, utilization management systems. And so we're working in a way where we've created a comprehensive platform that now allows us, like iOS on your iPhone, to partner with other entities who have interesting applications that can plug into DocOS.
Yep.
And work in an integrated, seamless way. So you think about all the different innovation that's happening in healthcare around technology and applications that in many ways it's awesome, right? So what Glenn and team have done at Livongo, I stand up and applaud. I think it's fantastic. But it's not integrated into the way care delivery works inside of an organization like ours.
Yeah.
And so I think they're going to enjoy some great success, but it won't be as good unless it's truly integrated into a comprehensive system. That's what we've built through DocOS. And DocOS not only then allows us to create better patient experiences, but frankly, it allows us to create a whole different kind of experience for the provider and the care team inside of the clinic. Because at the end of the day, we've got to be, going back to my first point, yeah, we got to be, if we're going to change healthcare, it's got to be changed for the patients as well as for the doctors.
So it's like you're reading my Cliff Notes here, because I was when you started this and you said, I have 2 points, I literally in my head, I was going, I hope the second point he says is tech. Because it's funny, like you would think, a show's called Technore, you would think that it's an assumption that the tech has the tactical advantage, and of course it is, but actually I think the part that gets glossed over the most frequently when we get to tech is, you mentioned the timeline. We've got this 6-8 year runway, it's really like a 16-year runway. That multiple is as a result of technology, because the reality is, yeah, all these companies have to change their thinking, which
right,
is maybe harder than even building the tech. When you start to build a tech, there are so many things that you don't know yet, and you couldn't possibly know. They'd have to poach your entire team. They'd have to buy you, really. And maybe they will. But like, they literally could not hire people to build a knockoff. It would have to have experienced all the pain that you did over that period of time. But what happens in the tech world is, you have built the tech already.
Right.
And so you are operating 5 to 10 times faster than they are operating right now. And they will slow down as they're building their tech, not speed up. They will go backwards. So you'll be gaining 10 times is now 15 to 20 times faster. So for the people listening, they're like, oh, I don't understand. Like, why is it going so much faster? It's like, literally, we are operating infinitely more efficiently. And when they try to make the move they have to make to catch us, they will have to go backwards 9 steps, in which case we will still be going full speed, if not faster, because we just raised a bunch of money and we're going to add more tech.
Yeah, you want a job? You're pretty good at this.
I should make a list of the times I get job offers just in case this shit falls apart. Now, you're the first guy I'm going to call. No, this is super fascinating. I think the last kind of thing I want to lead on is, I think it's important for people when they hear stories like this and they hear about you and they hear about your background and what you're trying to do, and obviously VillageMD, I would love for you to provide people an understanding of what the experience is like. So, like, we talk about the pain, but those that are doing things the old way, they know that pain. We don't need to take them down that memory. But to experience things the way that you provide, what is the difference from a patient standpoint? What am I going to, or even a clinician, what am I going to experience working with you versus working with what I'm used to, which sucks?
Yeah. So if I was to start with the patient, right?
Yeah.
So if you break down our $3.5 trillion healthcare industry, over 80% of the total spend in our healthcare industry is tied to patients who have chronic disease, right? So for the vast majority, by definition, the vast majority of people see their doctor once a year. They go in for a physical. Maybe they, you know, have a scrape on their knee that's too bad and they want to, you know, get some kind of treatment. But by and large, our healthcare system is so inefficient and so costly, right? So we spend more in the U.S. on healthcare on an annualized basis than like 20 of the next sort of most industrialized nations combined. Yeah. And it's unfortunate because it's really about, we're not focused on solving patient problems, yeah, right? So when you sort of look at it from that dynamic, our focus is on those patients who have chronic disease. And so if you think about it, then what is that person largely going through, right? They largely are experiencing the healthcare system 4 to 5 times per year through a doctor's visit, right? And that doctor's visit's a 15 to 20 minute encounter. And so it's a fairly small amount of time that they're spending with the doctor, in spite of the fact that they're living with that disease or set of diseases 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, right? And so for us, the most important thing that we do is that we leverage all the data that I talked about earlier to really identify those patients who are sickest and most in need of a different kind of experience. And that experience is a combination of extra human touch as well as leveraging technology so that we can be working with them to help them understand that we're with you that same 24/7. So you wake up 3 a.m. and you're not feeling well, we're available to you, right? You wake up 3 a.m, you're not feeling well, and we talk to you, and we're convinced that you're about to have a really acute episode. We're going to ensure that you get seen by one of our docs. We're going to ensure that if necessary, that you go to the ER. You get hospitalized. If you get hospitalized, it's a pretty confusing experience, yeah, for a lot of people,
for sure,
right? And you people coming in and out sort of throughout the day, and you're trying to sit there and figure out what's going on with me. Am I going to die? Am I going to, yeah, am I going to live?
How will I finance this?
Well, right. So there's this cocktail of things that are going on inside of someone's head, and there's not someone there that's a trusted advisor, a trusted physician to work with you to say, it's okay, we understand, here's what I think it is, and here's what our plan is, so that when you get discharged, we're going to ensure that you get transportation to the home. We're going to ensure that we come and see you within 24 or 48 hours of you being homebound. We're going to communicate with your daughter or son, who is your next of kin, to make sure they understand what's going on with mom or dad. All these things don't happen today in our healthcare system.
You mentioned the part of this about the transportation, what happens after they leave the hospital.
Yeah.
We just had the founder of Kaizen Health on, I don't know if you know Mindy well at all. She threw a stat out that just like blew my mind. It was like, I'm trying to remember this exactly. It was something like 38-40% of appointments are missed by a certain group of segment of people. And of that, 80% are missed because they couldn't get a ride to or from where they were going to go. And it solved, this is a stupid tangent, but it solved this weird thing that is going on in my head, because I live in a condo in Glen Ellen amongst people nicely say I live in an old age home. That's what they say. Yeah. I didn't say that. So if anyone's listening who's at the old age home, I mean my condo, I didn't say that. But I always wondered why the Pace bus would show up at 8 o'clock and there'd be a line of like elderly people tumbling into it. And then they would come back at like 6 p.m. And I'm like, where the hell, like, is it bingo at 8 a.m.? Like, what the hell is going on?
Yeah.
They're taking a Pace bus to Northwestern Medical and sitting there all day long and then waiting until the 6 p.m. pickup to go home, because their appointment was at anywhere between 8 and 6, and they didn't have any other way to go, and they didn't know any other way to go. And it's like, that's the kind of stuff where you're like, wow, like, unless you feel it, you would never know.
Well, and to that point, the fundamental question you have to ask is, why are they having to come to me?
Yeah.
Why am I not coming to them?
Yeah.
Right? And I get it. As for busy professionals, I don't know about you, but I feel like I'm on the go 24 hours a day.
I'm
like
leaving this interview and going to physical therapy for my 4-month-old child, so I get it.
And the reality is that in some cases, you need to go to a physical location for that to have to happen. But in other cases, we should be building a healthcare system. If we're focused on value and better outcomes and reducing the cost of healthcare, then we should be coming to you when it's needed, right? And so, you know, for us, the patient experience is one that more often than not, what we hear from our patients is, I used to feel like I was navigating the system entirely on my own.
Yeah.
Now I feel like two things. One, you guys care about me more than what I thought you did, right? Than what you used to before working with VillageMD. And the second is I feel like I have someone that's there for me to help answer my questions, whatever they are, and who's working with me to help me solve my problems. It's interesting. In every one of the markets we're in 8 metropolitan areas today, we build a booklet about every quarter of all these patient success stories. It's unbelievable.
Oh, I'm sure.
The number of people that just have known that their life is different, their outlook on life is different because of us bringing a proactive model. It's data-driven, technology-driven, in a way that helps you understand 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, that we are thinking about you and trying to help you solve your problem. So that's the patient experience.
And 100 years ago, it worked. 100 years ago, doctors showed up with their little bag and we didn't have a problem. Like, what? Why can't we still do that? I don't know this. I know nothing of this market other than to say, I got to imagine at least half of the treatments that are going on could be done in my house.
So here's the other interesting part about it, right? And that is, think about physician satisfaction.
Yep.
And so we live in a world now where physician satisfaction is, over the span of the last 30 years, it's at its lowest point, right? Docs see fewer patients per day now than what they saw 30 years ago.
Yep.
So people always say that the issue is that the docs are running on this treadmill. That's the problem. And they are, unfortunately, feeling like they run on a treadmill, but they really feel like they're not able to spend the time with their patients to solve their problems.
Yep.
And so one of the reasons why technology is such a key component of who we are and what we do is that we're able to systematically take away, you know, there's 300 things that they're now doing today that they weren't doing 30 years ago. We're able to one by one start taking those things off their plate and using technology to automate those things so that they can really get back to just focusing on the patient. And now they actually have other resources that we bring to the mix, right? So we've got 825 employees around the organization, and they're embedded out in these clinics to help the doctors extend the reach of care they can provide to their patients. And so there's nurses and social workers and pharmacists and data and analytics people who can help them understand the data to know who are the patients that we should be focused on and why. And let the doc ask the questions of us so that they develop the most comprehensive view. And so now they feel like, wait a minute, I used to just be trying to stamp out disease in 10, 15 minute increments. Now I've got a team of people who are working on my behalf to help deliver the best care that I can for all my patients.
It took 45 minutes, but I now completely understand the name of your company. Whoever came up with VillageMD as a name deserves a very, very bright gold star, because it really does. Like, I didn't think, I knew the company. I could read the bio.
Yeah.
I didn't put it in context. And now when you say all these things, and it immediately made my brain think of like the guy who shows up at our house with a big bag, and it's like, he's the village doctor, village MD.
Yeah.
Makes perfect. This is awesome. This is awesome. This is, I had a great time with you. Where do people go to get on it, to learn more about it, to follow you guys, to get all that information?
So villagemd.com is where you're going to find all the contact information for the corporate entity, as well as all the markets that we're in today. We have launched a new medical group called Village Medical. It's down in the Houston market, and we announced a partnership with Walgreens about 9 months ago, and partnership is focused on bringing full-service primary care closer to the neighborhood, making it more convenient, more accessible, but not just an interesting access point, but real primary care.
I would love to have you come on another time and talk just about this, because I think this is I love this topic. We've had people from the apps like Curable and the folks, the CIO of Walgreens, on the show in years past, and talked about specifically how you can solve this gigantic expensive problem that we're dealing with by simply weaning off the people who don't need to go sit in a hospital and just get them on their local corner where Walgreens is. And if they could just get a little bit deeper than a flu shot, you could solve a ton of problems. And hey, by the way, everyone gets a lot more money.
Right. Well, and the thing about it, right? So you asked me earlier if I'm optimistic.
Yeah.
I'm incredibly optimistic. And part of the reason is that, and this goes back to the fundamental founding of the business, which is that part of what we view our job to be is the democratization of data into the hands of people who can actually do something with it to deliver us a better healthcare system.
Totally.
I'm not a doc. I can't do it. I can't solve anyone's disease. I can't treat anyone's disease. But I can create an enablement vehicle so that more and more primary care docs know that they can deliver the best care they possibly can. And all of that insight and knowledge that they have, that they then work with us to build a better tech platform that translates into a better experience for them, is the reason why I'm pretty optimistic.
Full transparency, I had you definitely not pegged as the pessimist, because every healthcare person and legal and fintech, I will add, and government and nonprofit, who sits in this chair, the ones I know are the pessimists is as they begin to tell their story, they start to cringe. So I know that they're like, I got into this because I couldn't stand this, whatever. And it's like, all right, I know who you are. This has been a lot of fun, Tim. I really appreciate you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Of course. To apply to pitch on the Saturday Showcase live on WGN Radio, go to technori.com. Boom, that's a wrap.